Good evening, everyone, for welcome to Rugby Bits Pod number 22. Tonight, our focus will mainly be on the Six Nations, which is starting this weekend, and then we'll also review, of course, the URC games, especially the ones that happened in South Africa, and look into some of the Premiership and Top 14 highlights as well, and also spend some time to talk about one of the most dominant sports teams in sports right now, the Blitzboks, who just won yet another series and they've now won 34 matches in a row. I'm joined by Sean and Jared. Jared, Sean, you guys good?
Yeah, good weekend all for me. Got to see a bit of rugby. And how are you doing, Zala?
Good, thanks. Did you go to the Lions game?
I didn't end up going, no, but I did end up watching it at home, which was good either way.
Yeah. I think I might sneak over to the Stormers-Sharks game this weekend. I think it's time to get back to the stadiums. Sean, good weekend?
Yeah, good one. Busy. A lot of rugby, but it was busy and good. So yeah, I'm... looking forward to talking about all the things that we got to see this weekend.
Awesome. So let's get things started by first talking about the Guinness Six Nations. So last season, Wales were the Six Nations champions. In a surprise when people did not think that they would do so well after a bad run of games, which seems to be the start of this year's Six Nations already as well. This weekend, the matches will kick off with Ireland playing Wales at the Aviva, and then Scotland versus England at Murrayfield, and then France versus Italy on the Sunday. And then it'll go on for the next 2 months. Sean, I think let us start with the defending champions, with Wales. It seems like every time people expect something from Wales, they don't do as well. But when you expect nothing from Wales, they go on to win the Six Nations. So this seems like the script that we're following. They have lost pretty much each one of the experienced players. No Tipperick, no Spalletown, no Alan Jones, no Ken Owens. Yeah, how do you make sense of Wales right now? Are they going to surprise us once again?
I think that's a great intro. When they're expected to do well, they don't, and when they're not, they do. It's basically the Stormers of the Northern Hemisphere. But I don't think the Six Nations, it's so competitive with guys when sides are on form, and I think we probably could have one of the most competitive ones. Obviously, with France being in the mix, I mean, I really thought that they would grand slam it last season. And then obviously England are there and thereabouts. Ireland are always going to be in the mix. Obviously Wales and then Scotland have probably named one of their strongest squads in a while. So it's going to be very interesting. With regards to Wales, I reckon if they go back to back, I reckon that they will surprise a lot of people. I think they could probably, if France and Ireland and England weren't in such a good space, I reckon Wales could probably put their hand up a little higher, but I reckon they're in a little bit of trouble. And I think, obviously, as Ireland have picked up quite a few injuries and a couple of guys are missing out this week, and I'm not sure exactly all of them, but I know that there are a couple of key players missing out, which could help Wales. But, so I reckon Wales are probably going to finish... I think if they're lucky, they'll finish second, possibly third.
Okay, that's quite, I think, optimistic compared to most people probably have them around fifth place. Jared, if we remember last season, Wales just seemed to have the fortunate knack of having their opponents get red cards against them during the course of the Six Nations and even in the November series. They seemed like every win that they had was... you know, a red card for the opposition was a massive factor. So I don't know if this is something that they coach in terms of maybe getting their body positions lower for high tackles, or they just seem to attract a few stupid plays from their opponents. But we saw in the November series that they weren't as convincing. They faced all three of the four Southern Hemisphere rugby championship teams and only won against Australia, probably a bit lucky. But I think the two players that performed really well was Ennis Jenkins and Payne Basham. What do you expect from them in the Six Nations?
Yeah, well, I think Wales will always have a brilliant back row. They seem to lose tons of players every Six Nations, every autumn, every June. And no matter how many players they lose, they seem to put out either a world-class or very close to world-class back row. So I think that's where one of their big strengths will be. You mentioned Tane Basham and Ellis Jenkins. They both incredible players. I think they could throw James Ratty there in the back row. He's been playing good rugby as well. And then you have Ross Moriarty back in the mix. And yeah, a lot of people forget about Moriarty, but he captained the British and Irish Lions in 2017. He's a hell of a player. So yeah, I think Wales are one of those teams that just always seem to stay in the fight. And yeah, they have got some props with smashable faces that sort of got them a few red cards for the opposition last year. And yeah, maybe they'll get lucky again. But yeah, I think with fans returning to the stadiums in the UK and Wales and everywhere over the Six Nations, I think they'll play a big factor. And playing at the Millennium is huge for Wales. So I wouldn't write them off too soon. I think they could even grab another title, and then everyone will be shocked. But their team still looks like a high quality team. Their overall squad.
Yeah, that's I think exactly what people how Wales want others to perceive them as, maybe just a little bit understrength so they can surprise people again. Sean, just the last thing on Wales, and probably their biggest selection headache, is what they're going to do in the midfield. So we've probably their premier midfield player in the last 10 years has been Jonathan Davies, but he's been in and out. He's been a bit out of form probably for a year or two. You have Nick Tompkins, you have Willis Halaholo, and you have Owen Watkins. And I think PVAC has not necessarily nailed down who are his starting centres, because not all of them have been available at the same time. Never mind George North, who's also out injured right now. What would you do in the midfield?
Well, for starters, I'd have Halaholo starting. So I know he can play 12 and 13, but he's a better 12. I would rather have him starting at 12, and then you probably could mix it up between probably Tompkins at 13. But I think Tompkins has been interesting. Like, he really does offer a lot, but he seems to fall in and out of favor. He's almost seems to be a little bit like a Hugh Jones, but where Hugh Jones is playing all around the back line, where Tompkins is playing 12 and 13. And he has some good ones. He's got a bit of a game breaker, solid on defense, but he has slipped up every now and then. I suppose he is still quite inexperienced and young when it comes to test level. But yeah, I'd have Halaholo at 12, and then that 13, I think, is a little bit open at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that will be one of the big selection calls that Wade Pivak makes. Dan Bigger also is the captain for Wales for the first time. Good luck to all the referees. So let's move on. Speaking of referees, let's move on to England. Probably the bane of every referee's existence right now. They're actually not. They as usual, they always have a strong squad, but this time it does seem like they have lost a few players either to injury in the long term with regards to players like Owen Farrell, Johnny May, and then possibly just for the first game for the likes of Courtney Laws and Joe Marler. So it does look like a lot more of the youngsters will be playing for England than they had in the November test. So England in the November test introduced a lot of youngsters into some key positions. They had Marcus Smith playing fly half, they had Freddie Stewart at the back. Alex Dornbrandt had a big influence. They started being involved in some of the big tests against the Springboks, for example. So it seems like Eddie Jones is making an intentional drive to try and renew this team. I think the big selection call is again in the midfield for England, or almost generally in the whole back line. And probably the only people that are nailed onto their positions are the 19 and 15, Ben Youngs, Marcus Smith, and Freddie Stewart. Jared, how would you go about it, and then what do you think Eddie will do for the rest of the back line?
Yeah, I think this is a sort of, it's weird to say it so soon, but almost like a career-defining tournament for Marcus Smith. It's his first full Six Nations campaign. And I think Eddie wanted Owen Farrell there to run the back line with him. And him not being there, I think he's a major blow, but it's also just as much of an opportunity for Marcus Smith. I don't see Eddie Jones throwing George Ford or Smith into that number 12 jersey. So I think there's a lot of disruption in that England backline, but Eddie also feels that it's now a young players game, the test arena. So we've seen how successful France have been in throwing in those youngsters. And maybe it could be a similar campaign for England. It just depends where he's going to be able to get those, get his side of those close encounters. Like England and Wales are always close. Scotland can always push England all the way. So yeah, I think it's a very testing tournament that awaits them. Personally, I'd stick with Ben Youngs at scrum off. I think you're right there. I think you're right with Stewart at fullback as well. I think he's going to go with Henry Slade and Luke Northmore in the centres. Northmore gives him a bit of that Harlequins feel for Marcus Smith. That's if Joe Marchant isn't ready for the game, which I don't think he will be. I think he's out for COVID for the first game. So, yeah, and then you start looking at the wingers. And without Watson and May, who have been there pretty much the whole Eddie Jones era, you start looking around and you'd ask yourself if he's going to throw in Jack Noel straight back into the mix. I think he might just. And then you're looking if he's going to go Elliot Daly or Ollie Hassel-Collins on the other wing. So I think Eddie will be throwing a few surprises at us. If asked to guess the backline, I'd probably go Ben Youngs, Marcus Smith. In the centres, I reckon he'll go with Henry Slade and Luke Northmore. And I think he'll put Elliot Daly in with Jack Noel and Freddie Stewart at fullback. I see a lot of people are calling for Mark Atkinson in the midfield. I don't think Eddie's I think he would rather go with the younger option than put Mark Atkinson in there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think there's a lot of options, and now with Joe Marchant also out due to COVID this weekend, it will be a very green English backline. I think the most experienced player after Youngs will probably be Henry Slade. Sean, what is your take on the English backline?
Yeah, I can't really argue with Jared spoke about it at 9 and 15 in the wingers. I think it'd be quite interesting. I think Eddie Jones has got quite a few more factors to deal with when he juggles everyone around. But I'm going to focus on the 10, 12, 13. It's such a tough one because Marcus Smith is undoubtedly that everyone believes and sees him as a starting 10. And I think it really is important that Farrell would have been there. So now with the mix up and the mess up at 12, I think my 12 and 13 are going to stay the same, I reckon. But I think I'm going to take I'm going to actually go for a absolute big tonk here. But I reckon George Ford starts at 10. And I reckon that Atkinson starts at 12 and Slade starts at 13. If Smith starts, then Slade could possibly move into 12, and then your 13's up in the air. I just want to say I'm absolutely gutted that Marchant's not playing this weekend. I mean, it's no secret, but I think he's flippin' brilliant. I think he's one of the best outside centres in England, and he's probably would have started on the wing because Eddie Jones likes it. But I still think he's a great shout. But yeah, I reckon Atkinson and Slade at 12 and 13, and then I'm going to just go and really throw it out there and say Ford's going to start at 10 and Smith will be on the bench.
Just quick, maybe just for maybe people that are listening that are not as familiar with Atkinson and Northmore, especially Sean or maybe Jared, actually, can you maybe describe how they play, how Atkinson and Northmore play?
Yeah, without being too disrespectful, I think Mark Atkinson is your Andre Essays and that you buy and wish kind of thing. He's a big, aggressive inside centre, but also quite a bit skillful, gets the ball away, good offloads. Northmore is quite a tricky one. I think he's really burst through this season and really made his mark on that Harlequin side. He joined them just after Dom Brandt did, and this season he sort of, they signed Hugh Jones, and like, you looked at it and you're like, okay, well, Hugh Jones sort of just slips into that 13 jersey alongside Estes, and they push Marchand to the wing kind of thing, and Northmore sort of saw that as a challenge and has taken up that challenge. He's a very slick running back. He's also quite... well versed with his offloads and running lines. So, yeah, I think he's a very good player. It's quite a very Eddie Jones kind of player that he ticks all of your boxes, and so he's quite swift on defense. He's handling, he's kicking, it's all top-notch. So I think he could really break into the team during the Six Nations. Whether he stays there once a big boy like Manny Terlaghi comes back and Owen Farrell's back, I'm not sure. But if he impresses Eddie doesn't forget quickly.
No, that's true. Thanks for that. And I think just to move to the forwards, I still think England has issues there as well, especially if Joe Marler is not available. Jones has chosen to not select Marco Pignapolo again. So once Marler's out, it's then there's a lot of responsibility on Ellis Gage in the loose head, and then probably Bevan will come in as the reserve. And you know, he had a decent start to his test career in November, but he'll be under pressure again in the next few games as he plays in Six Nations. In tight head, it's almost resting on Kyle Sinclair almost exclusively. Will Stewart will come in, but the English front row isn't necessarily the biggest or the strongest in terms of their scrummaging or the set piece. So that will be an area that teams such as Ireland, for example, like France, can try to target them in the set piece and put them under pressure. But apart from that, it'll be interesting how they replace Johnny Hill. If I'm not mistaken, I think he's out at least for the first few games. So not having Hill and not having Courtney Laws at least for the first game, he's still touch and go for the Scotland game. Those would be very hard players to replace. So does someone like Ewells come into the locks? It will be very interesting. Maybe Chesson can come in, but yeah, he's only played two seasons in the Premiership, so he'd be very good for a big test match against Scotland. But the England pack isn't necessarily as strong, even though it still has some world-class operators like Itoje and Curry. I'm sure Dawn Brandt will be entrusted with more responsibility at 8. But Sean, I think the question is very simple, especially from this Owen Farrell stance. Is it possible for England to even win without Owen Farrell?
That's a great question, because everyone, every non-English and Saracens player love to hate the guy, and they don't really see his value. But there's no doubt about the value that that he can offer. But I think, as with most sides, and it's quite prevalent, especially in the Springbok setup, is how the senior players all get together and how it is all like. There is a captain, but there is a leadership group on the field and on the bench, and everyone knows the pecking order and knows the way that they're going. And I think losing Farrell's big. I think if you look at who else they've lost along that, and you mentioned, I mean, Courtney Laws, Joe Marler, you know, that's massive. And they're guys that are going to have to step up that are going to really, you know, there are a couple of guys in the front row that are going to have to step up and really put their hand up, where we're used to them kind of, if you look at like Sinclair and a couple of the guys, like we're happy for them and everyone's happy for them to really push the edge because they're able to. So someone who's got to play a little bit probably more maturely in terms of how they react off the ball, on the ball, stuff like that, is probably going to change up. And I do think the dynamic has changed a little bit with England, with losing so much experience, especially for the Calcutta Cup, especially because they haven't won it in, I'm taking a stab here, it's 3 years, maybe four. I think it's 4 years. I think it's huge. So it's not just Farrell, but I will tell you, they will miss Farrell a lot because they're missing a lot in the back line too, having lost Marchant and stuff like that. So they really, really are struggling to fill vital roles in the team that have experience.
Okay, awesome. Just want to remind listeners that if you'd like to come in, if you'd like to make a comment, ask a question, you're more than welcome to request to speak. Love to hear your thoughts about the Six Nations. We've discussed Wales, we've discussed England. We're moving on now to France. I think the French have probably been everyone's favourites, but they also have more COVID than injuries at the moment. They've had a lot of their players that didn't look like they'd make it for the first few games, but the likes of Dupont and Mark have been able to come back and play for Toulouse on Saturday. Jalibert also played for Bordeaux, but I think Jared, France's biggest concern is that their best players are all a bit rusty and out of form.
Yeah, I think you're right with that. Toulouse losing on the weekend at home to Montpellier would not have been ideal for Galtier. A large portion of his team comes out of Toulouse. But the one thing about picking such a young team is that some of the times these guys don't let that kind of conversation of rustiness or lack of game time really get to their head. They'll just be excited to pull on the blue jersey again and go for the country kind of thing. So I think that does play sort of in their favour. And I think another great thing for them is they start off their campaign against Italy, with all due respect to Italy. I think that they couldn't have asked for a better start considering the disruptions that they've had in camp. I think they'll pretty much hit the ground running. They'll probably be... Well, when I say hit the ground running, it'll probably take them the first half to shake off and sort of warm up the legs and get the blood flowing. And I reckon they'll sort of wipe Italy out in the last 30 minutes of the game, 20 minutes of the game.
And then just a quick follow-up, Jared. You maybe have an inside track on which relatively unknown French 20-year-old will become a global superstar by the end of the Six Nations?
Oh, I'm not too sure this time around. I see that they have called up a Pro D2 star, Leo Colli. He played under 20s not too long ago. He's also a scrum half, which makes it quite difficult for him to break into the match day squad. I don't see too many breaking through this time. I did read the other day that Galtier and Savard said that they sort of going to stick with their go-to men for the entire competition to try and sort of get a better run into the year and through into the next World Cup. So I don't know. I think they will pick a very settled squad and we won't see too many surprises throughout the competition.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting to watch. I think there are maybe one or two possible surprises, especially at Lock. With Van der Berg, plays for Castro. He's just a big slab of meat, pretty much, at 21 years old. There's also, trying to get the name of the other lock as possible to be, I think he's Paul Willems' teammate.
They have very similar names, the two of them. The only reason I don't see that happening too quickly is that Gaultier is a very big fan of Paul Willems, and he seems to like Cameron Wachey there in the second row as well. So he's got those two guys that will probably be his go-to, and he has Flamme from Toulouse as well.
And also Bernard Leroux, who's also a big favourite of Gaultier and the French setup. So, like, it's going to be interesting to see how they juggle it about.
Yeah, I didn't name him just purely on the fact that he seemed to fall a little bit out of favour a bit last year. No injuries.
It's fine. I'll just kick you off the podcast. It's okay. You can't not mention him. I think they arrested him. See, it's all how you package it, you see. I think they rested him and they gave him some time and whatever because they're going to need him for the World Cup. So, see, I fixed it for you.
I think Tao Fofana is also someone that they have a lot of time for in France. He's usually used as almost like an impact player to play in the last 30 minutes. I think it does seem like that there is maybe on two sides. On one side, it seems like Gaultier does want to stick with the fire and test it at least at lock. But on the other, he does seem like wants to refresh and renew because I think he was thinking maybe he's not getting as much for no offense to these great players, especially to South Africans. But he's not necessarily getting as much from the Leroux, Willemse, Tao Fofana combination. So I guess that's where someone like Cameron Wachey comes in. Flamme has also had his opportunity. We'll see. That's maybe the one place in the French team that there is a gap. I think the other might be for Jules Favre. He plays, I think, for La Rochelle. And, he has an opportunity to maybe push someone out like a Tower, who hasn't been at his absolute best this season. He can probably go into 12 and then Gelfrick moves to 13. With Arthur Vincent still injured, I think there's an opportunity there for someone to probably raise their hand there in the midfield. Sean, I think it does seem like that there is maybe on two sides. On one side, it seems like Gaultier does want to stick with the fire and test it at least at lock. But on the other, he does seem like wants to refresh and renew because I think he was thinking maybe he's not getting as much for no offense to these great players, especially to South Africans. But he's not necessarily getting as much from the Leroux, Willemse, Tao Fofana combination. So I guess that's where someone like Cameron Wachey comes in. Flamme has also had his opportunity. And we'll see. That's maybe the one place in the French team that there is a gap. I think the other might be for Jules Favre. He plays, I think, for La Rochelle. And he has an opportunity to maybe push someone out like a Tower, who hasn't been at his absolute best this season. He can probably go into 12 and then Gelfrick moves to 13. With Arthur Vincent still injured, I think there's an opportunity there for someone to probably raise their hand there in the midfield. Sean, I think the question is also relatively simple for France. Are they able to put together, five matches five great matches in a row and win the Six Nations, or at least four out of the five to get close to the championship?
I absolutely think they can. My fingers were burnt a little last season by massively committing to them grand slamming. They end up not even winning it, let alone grand slamming it. I think they can. And I mean, on Sunday when they announced the guys that they were bringing back into the squad, I was like, oh, who they're bringing back? And then I had a look at that list and I'm like, shit, they're basically the, 14 players they brought back in. I reckon you could start 13 of them. So, I mean, they're in a really good space. And I think they've got a really good vibe going. I think their squad looks great together. I think they're really in a good space. And I think they would have learned a hell of a lot on last season. And also in the Autumn Nations Cup, when everyone, when we came out of that first lockdown, I mean, did they lost to England in the final, didn't they? Jared, correct me if I'm wrong. But the
They did, I think, with the second string team as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. They named a bizarre side. So I think there's a lot of, if you look back, there's a lot that they've been building towards, and they've done it mostly with a settled squad or guys that have come in and basically have said, listen, this is it. You know, this is how we're doing it. We'll name larger squads, but these are the core guys and all that. So I think if you look at back at those last 2 years and the learnings that they would have taken out of it as a squad and look at how they've grown with their relationship with their clubs and with how things are happening in France, I reckon they could really easily go Grand Slam it.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. Just looking at their fixtures, they have probably the two toughest games at home, which is a good advantage against Ireland and against England at the end. They have to travel to Scotland and to Wales. They, in particular, not been great in Scotland. I think they haven't won their last three tries. So that, I think that'll be sort of the make or break for the Six Nations. And England and Ireland, although they're going to France, I think they will fancy their chance, or Ireland especially will fancy, you know, causing an upset there, especially because they're playing in the second weekend straight after their game against Italy. So if there's an opportunity for Ireland to win the Six Nations, it has to start with their maybe stealing an away win and start at France. Let's move on to Italy. Unfortunately, it is a bit of a quick conversation, but I think Italy is more of a long-term project than it is a this-year project. They'll probably lose all five matches again, unfortunately. But for once, there is some excitement about the young players. I mean, I think everyone knows about Paolo Garbisi, but, you know, with players like Stefan Varney as well, they seem to be getting things together for hopefully becoming competitive, you know, in the future. We know that Franco Smith is involved, I think, as almost like a director of rugby, if I'm not mistaken, with Kieran Crowley as the coach. Sean, is there any particular players you're looking forward to seeing from the Italy side?
Well, Michele Campagnaro is not in the squad, so no. Garbisi is a bit of a cop out in terms of picking him because he's probably the most exciting player there. But I really am looking forward to watching him and watching him grow and seeing how he's built and pushed on and obviously now playing in France. Like, he's becoming a hell of a lot more high profile. The expectation is there, so I'm looking forward to seeing what they've got going. Italy will probably still be persisting with their new defensive setup, which was similar to the Springboks I don't know, the foundations of the Springbok setup. Forgive me, I lost my words there. But
I think the defensive coach, I'm just trying to get his name quickly, but he's basically a Minerva discipler. So he's, they try to do a rush defense. It's not necessarily as clean as the Springboks, but it gets the job done sometimes.
Yeah, and it takes time to get going. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Rossi and Jacques, when they took over the book, said it would take a minimum of 2 years. It would take 2 years for the Springboks to get the setup right. They're still busy doing that. But remember that they played some exciting rugby. Like, they pushed, oh, damn it, I can't remember who it was. Was it France or Ireland? They really pushed them hard in Italy for about 20, 30 minutes in the game. It was a thrilling game. And then they fell away. So I think that they would have built a lot on their, sorry, it was during November. But anyway, in one of their recent games, I probably should pay a bit more attention. But it really, like, they really have grown a lot, and they've had a lot to build on. So, and they seem to have a bit more continuity there, which is great for them. So yeah, Garbisi is the one I want to watch, and I'm also excited to see what they deliver. And Garbisi is the man that can deliver it, to be fair.
Yeah, I think it's a very exciting game plan on both sides. In attack, they seem to be trying to keep the ball alive. They're trying to get the ball, you know, as quick as possible to Martiani on the wing. And defensively, it's rush, it's aggressive, it's at the front foot. So it can maybe work and put sides under pressure, as we saw with the All Blacks, or it can mean that you get beaten by 60 points. Jared, anything to add about Italy?
I think Italy will probably end the tournament with 5 losses again. But I do think that they're not going to break the record that they set last year with the most points shipped. I think it was over 200. I think it was 230-odd or something like that. I think they'll be a lot more competitive, and I think they'll be a bit more competitive for longer periods of the game. So I think they will try to hold on until the 50th or 60th minute. And, I'm quite excited for their captain, Michel Lamaro. He had a big year last year. And especially with them lose, I think they lost Bramstein, they lost Negri, and they lost Jack Paledri. And that was pretty much their starting back row at the World Cup. So I think he's a big, big player to watch out for this season. And they've also called up a Pro D2 player, Angie Capasio, I think it is. He's quite an exciting outside back. He's a small dude. And, if he gets a run out, I wouldn't be shocked if he scored a blinder during the competition.
Yeah, and I'm also looking forward to seeing Federico Mori playing in on the wing as well. He's, I think, still 20 years old. And, he looks like a good finisher. And I think they might, hopefully, there'll be some confidence taken from the majority of the Italian squad does play for Benetton, and Benetton's been doing pretty well in the URC, so they'll hopefully be trying to compete as well as possible. Let's move on to Scotland. As Sean said a little bit earlier, looks like one of the strongest Scotland squads, I think, in at least in recent history, and for once it does look like there's more than just two players that Scotland that other teams will try to take away from Scotland. They've got pretty much all their key players injury-free, from Rory Sutherland up front to Johnny Gray to Hamish Watson to Chris Harris, and then obviously to the two magic men, Finn Russell and Stuart Hogg. I think it's probably time now for Scotland to put their promise into some more big victories and for them to make a big title push here.
Yeah, I think I think they really do need to kind of start not just rocking the boat, but actually really starting to make it work. And I think they can. I think this game on Saturday is their absolute. They've obviously been focusing on it for a while. You're able to get together, spend a hell of a lot more time preparing for your first game, and especially being something so big against England. They will most certainly be looking at getting a campaign underway with a win and possibly 5 points. And that's really what you want. Your opening game is massive. You want that platform to be able to move forward. So I think they've got... The thing is Scotland against England, Scotland always lift their game up, and so do England, but England have generally been walking it. Obviously not the last 4 games, but in history, England have probably got the upper hand. And I think Scotland are not going to be a surprise for them anymore. And I think Eddie Jones is going to make sure that the England side are as ready as can be, obviously with all their disruptions. But Scotland seemed pretty good. Jared, I think I saw something today. Scotland lost a few players. How many did they lose and who were they?
I think it was only 1 or 2 players, but the one was Josh Bayliss, who's been playing really well for Bath. But he's been a standout for Bath, very rubbish Bath team. They've lost Jamie Batty as well, one of their props, Sean Maitland is the other player.
But they just brought him in.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. So I think they'll be okay. I don't think they're going to have too much of a problem with their wingers. In terms of that You'll probably find they'll probably draft Kyle Stain onto the wing if they need. I prefer him to be playing at 13, but I don't think that they see him as a 13 in the Scotland setup. But it's all obviously how things pan out. But I think their backs are flipping exciting. I really think they should start Stain. I love what he brings to the game and how like aggressive he is, but also like he's the epitome of just making things work. Because he just pushes so hard, he executes really well, he makes pretty much good decisions all the way around. So it's going to be very interesting to see what they bring. They're playing at home, playing in front of the home crowd. I think Scotland could probably pip it, but I do think it's probably going to be close on a 50-50 call to see who wins that game.
I don't think you're far off there, but we must remember that Scotland did beat England at Twickenham last year, and it was the first time, I don't even know how many years, I think it was since the 90s or something ridiculous like that. So
83,
there we go. And I think that's will be a big driving factor for Gregor and his squad, and equally so for Eddie. I think Scotland made quite a few clever call-ups with, I think it's Andy Christie from Saracens. He's also a nice big blindside slash lock kind of player. And they've got exciting talents all over the place. The one thing that I did find quite surprising was Adam Hastings left out of the squad. And I don't know if it was the Six Nations before where they sort of lost Ben Russell and Stuart Hogg ended up playing 10 in one of the games. So yeah, I'm not overly convinced that Blair Kinghorn is a test match level fly half, but Gregor definitely knows way more than you when it comes to a fly half.
Yeah, very. That was so interesting. I tell you something that I picked up when they announced the Scotland squad, and Hastings wasn't in it. So obviously, it was a big surprise for many. But I had a look at the Gloucester side that played the week before. Gloucester would have lost in their starting back line of the side that they named after the Scotland squad were named. It was the weekend afterwards. They lost every single one of their back line except one to international call-ups this week for the Six Nations. So Gloucester are probably secretly super happy that he's not gone, because they've lost a hell of a lot of players. But I agree. I don't think, I mean, he's not that much of a loose cannon that he can't be picked. I mean, he's pretty handy. Like, if I look at like Hugh Jones not being selected and Hastings not being selected, I can understand why Hugh Jones is not selected, but I can't understand why Hastings isn't. So it's going to be a baptism of fire for Kinghorn, and we'll see how that goes. But it's going to, you know, it's all resting on Finn, and to be fair, he's probably going to play every single minute. Maybe not against Italy, but he'll probably play in every game if they're in with a shout. So everything really pivots around Russell staying fit.
They can't even put in Cameron Redpath into 10 if they really want to. That brings me to sort of my next question about the 12 jersey. I think we all know who plays 10, 13, and 15, and I think the wings are relatively sorted. There is probably a little battle between Stain and Rufus McLean for 14. But the 12 jersey is quite interesting. You can put in Sam Johnson, who's, you know, probably been the incumbent for a long time. Cam Redpath has just come back from injury. And, of course, he was brilliant in this match last year. And Sione Tupilotu has been playing really well in the URC as well. Jared, do you have a particular preference for the
12
jersey?
Yeah, I'm quite a big fan of this Cameron Redpath. And in the same breath, I'm a very big Sam Johnson fan. So Johnson doesn't seem to satisfy Townsend all the time. He's in the team and he plays well and he cements himself. And then the next time the squad is picked, he's not even picked in the squad or gets picked later in November. So I think the fact that Redpath has been picked off, two or three games worth of fitness, I think he rates him very highly. he played that England game. I think he got through 63 minutes or something like that, and that was pretty much his last game before his most recent run of matches. So I think he will go for Redpath in at 12, and I would too.
Sean?
Yeah, I'd actually probably go with Sam Johnson. I think I'd like to see Tupilotu start, but I don't think he'll start. I think he's maybe got to just spend some time first before he can get started. But I mean, I think Farrell's playing at 13, no doubt about it. And I think Johnson's probably going to... Harris is going to play at 13. Sorry, my mistake. And I think Johnson takes 12. But it is Redpath. Redpath really played well. And the only reason why I'm saying Johnson starts is I think possibly Redpath maybe just needs another week or so. But you never know. Are they going to start him and risk him and then put Johnson on the bench? I mean, he has been playing. It's not like he's not fit, but I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But I would go Johnson at 12.
Okay, and then that brings us to our last team, Ireland, who are probably the favourites for the Six Nations this year. Interestingly enough, they are playing their two toughest games on the road. They're playing in Paris and at Twickenham, but they've got both Scotland and Wales at home. And I think this is off the back of a very impressive November series for them, and just looking that Ireland has, and Andy Farrell has figured out a few things. Now, they look enterprising, they look attacking, there was a lot of offloading and just dynamics sort of keeping the ball alive type of play from the Irish in November. I think the big selection question for Ireland, Sean, is what they're going to do to replace James Lowe. So they've got, you know, some more established players like, or just in the wings in general, they've got the likes of Conway and Lama and Keith Earls that can play there, but they also have some just great young guns. Rob Ballacroon, Mike Hansen, Mark Lowry, that can also go onto the wing. It's going to be very important to see who plays on the wings next to their fullback, Hugo Keenan.
Yeah, so Keith Earls is out. He's out this weekend. I'm not sure for how long. So quite interesting that we're talking about how on earth they're going to replace James Lowe when it almost only seems like one game ago or two games ago that everyone was like, okay, fine, he can play test rugby, but everyone was kind of in doubt in the beginning. So I think they're going to have to chop and change a little bit and see what they're going to do. I think... Ballacroon is in tremendous form at the moment. He's really really looking good. He's come off quite a bit of quite a bad injury, and he's really kind of cooking at the moment. So I think he might be in with the shouts on the left. I think probably Conway will start on the right, and then I think Keenan or maybe. Oh, I don't know. The fullback could be interesting between Keenan and Lama. So I think I'd probably go with Ballacoon on the left and Conway on the right.
Yeah, that sounds pretty... I think that sounds like what Andy Farrell would do. Jared, how do you think the game and the sort of offloading and attacking game that worked quite well against, you know, All Blacks and Argentina, do you think it'll work as well, you know, the Six Nations, you know, it's not going to be the best conditions. Can they do sort of the whole offloading and ultra-attacking game against, maybe England's getting a bit more open with their game plan, but, you know, these are very tight and very tense matches usually.
Yeah, I think Ireland are set up for a big Six Nations tournament. This is sort of the years where they normally peak, either a year or 2 years out from a World Cup. So it wouldn't be bad money to place a bet on an Ireland Six Nations Grand Slam. But
yeah, they're going to Grand Slam it and null everyone.
Yeah, that's the true Irish way. But I do think it is a litmus test of how well the structure actually works against the other nations. a team like Scotland are very good at the breakdown with Hamish Watson and Jamie Ritchie, and Wales are just as good with Ellis Jenkins and Tate Basham. So I think that's where the test will really come, is if those kind of teams are able to slow down their attack, and instead of it being 1 and 2 second rucks, it's turning into 3 and 4, and if they're able to regenerate that kind of tempo to their game. I do think one James Lowe is a big blow for them, and I think it's not just his attacking ability, but also his big left boot. Sean can correct me, but I don't think they have another big boot that's already settled in the team. So I don't know how they're going to compensate with that. If someone like Ringrose, that kicks very well out of hand, he's a well-rounded footballer, will be able to sort of negate the loss of Lowe in that part of the game or not. I do think Hansen or Lowry could be a little bit of a better option than maybe Balakun, just because they a little bit more hands-on and playmaker style. They're almost like two fullbacks, both of them, in the sense of how they get involved in the game. I don't see Keenan losing the fullback jersey. He's played pretty much every test as Ireland's fullback under Farrell, and I don't think that's going to change the Six Nations. But yeah, they've got the players in form to win the Six Nations, and I wouldn't be surprised if they go ahead and do it. I think the only player besides Keith Rawls that's not available this weekend is Joey Carberry, and then you're looking at Jack Carty as his backup on the bench, and Sexton, if he doesn't get injured, he'll play 80 minutes.
Yeah, that's obviously a very big if, but yeah, if he's available, he plays probably the whole game. So now it's time to put our money where our mouth is, gentlemen, and make some predictions. So I want you who's going to be the Six Nations champion and who's going to be the player of the tournament. Just to give you guys a little bit of time to stall, I think what probably will be the big deciding matches for the Six Nations are Scotland versus England in the first weekend. Can Scotland start good at home and start off their Six Nations on a good note? If England loses this, it makes it very hard to see them win the Six Nations from there. In the second week, France plays Ireland, France is at home. That probably might decide it just in and of itself, because France wins it, they stop Ireland from going and taking a clean sweep. And if Ireland wins it, they look good for the Six Nations and even good for a Grand Slam possibly. Then in week 3, you have Scotland versus France. Scotland's playing in Murrayfield. France doesn't have a good history in Murrayfield. So that's probably the match that they need to win, especially if they don't have a victory against Ireland at home. And then the last match of the Six Nations, England versus France, with England versus Ireland the week before that. England, if they want to win the Six Nations, will probably have to beat both Ireland and France. France at home, that's going to be a very tall order, even for Eddie Jones' men. And then England playing at home and playing at Twickenham against Ireland. Ireland will probably also have to try and secure that game if they want to win. So it's always tough with the Six Nations because home ground advantage matters a lot, but it's all about form and availability and all those good things. And it'll be, I think, very close between, at the very least, the first five nations are looking very strong right now. So Sean, I'll put you on the spot. Six Nations champion, will they get the Grand Slam, and who's the player of the tournament?
Okay. I say France win it. Yes, they will Grand Slam. And I reckon Aldrit gets player of the tournament.
Oh, okay, that's fantastic. I think that's a great prediction. Jared?
Yeah, I also think France is going to win it. I don't think they're going to Grand Slam. I think they'll probably lose one on their way to it. And I also think it's going to be a loose forward that's going to win the player of the tournament. I was also thinking of I was also thinking of Aldrete, but I'm going to mix it up and I'm going to go with Caelan Doris.
Oh, nice. That's good. I think I'm going to go with Ireland just by an edge. That second week game, I think, is a bit too soon for France. I'm hoping they can sort themselves out and, you know, the likes of Dupont can get themselves back into form. But I think that's probably the toughest match, and it probably comes a bit too early. So Ireland wins after getting the win in Paris, but they lose the tournament, so they won't get a Grand Slam. And my player of the tournament will be Ronan Kelleher. So, yeah, I think he's looking to sort of step out as one of the key players for the Irish team. Actually, funny enough, all three players that I mentioned are on the top 25, under 25 article that's on the Rugby Blitz website now. So why I listed the players that the best 25 players that were born after the 1st of Jan in 1997. And yeah, it's very interesting to see who has the lion's share of the talent, who's looking good, who looks like they will dominate World Rugby for the next 10 years. So please go to the Rugby Blitz website after this and go and have a look at that list. Let's move on to, I think first let's just have a quick word on, you know, one of sport's most dominant teams at the moment, 34 and counting for the Blitzbox. Sean, I could probably just speak about Salvin Davis just all the time myself, but I think we need to just, you know, commend Neil Powell and the Blitzbox structures because they have gone through a big transition. Yes, you know, the likes of DJ New Zealand aren't able to play, but they have lost, you know, most of their first choice sevens players that have gone on to play for teams, and it's been a seamless transition into this new generation of players.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, you know. We tied second for the most ever consecutive wins, and we've won all four tournaments this season. And if I'm not mistaken, I think we won the last two last season, but definitely the last one. So we've five, maybe six tournaments on the trot. We've lost a lot of players. There are a lot of new guys there, and yeah, Salvin Davids is incredible, but it's the same thing as always with the Blitzbox. They are always a team. They're always a core. They're like, if you just look at how happy everyone is for everyone else, when guys score tries, when things happen, it's really next level. They are off the charts. And the thing is like, I will say something is a lot of people are saying, yeah, but Fiji aren't playing and this and that. Like, well, you know, that sucks for them. We've been there. We are the only side that has not, we visibly doesn't look like we've dropped off from where we were before the lockdown, which everyone else has. Everyone else is not where they used to be, is still trying to get it going again. They're building. And I think that is absolutely remarkable. And that's all the setup that they have at Stellenbosch and how they work it and how they manage it and how everything goes. And flip, they're unbelievable. And we got a lot more to see. It's the World Cup. South Africa hosting the World Cup this year. So we're obviously massively in with a shout there. I'm so happy, man. What a great side and what a great bunch of guys.
Yeah, they're playing absolutely brilliantly right now. And yes, big credit to Neil Powell. And it seems like they are transitioning from Neil Powell to Sandile Njobo, who's the current Sevens Academy coach. He seems to be the person that's going to succeed Powell once he's for the Sharks. So it's great in terms of succession planning that we're able to just get this new group of players and coaches and for the machine to still run. Jared, I think what's so great about the Blitzbox when you watch them is they just have such a set way of how they play. It works such a charm in sevens, you know. They have a really aggressive defense. They're able to, you know, they're able to use their key players in order to blow the game wide open. And you know, it's such a strong template, and it's very hard to beat for other sides.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think what Neo has done so well is that there's always talk about the brotherhood that is the Blitzbocker. And once you're a Blitzbock, you're always a Blitzbock. And just the way the guys play for one another, and it's such a cliche, but you can just see it on the field. Like when a new guy comes into the setup and he scores his first try, the whole squad goes absolutely mad. And yeah, it's a kind of environment that you want to be involved in. And yeah, you see guys like Quokka and Sinatla move away to try and make it in the 15s game, but that it's you sort of feel that they leave in that environment with a heavy heart, knowing that they've got other dreams that they want to catch but don't really want to leave. So I think that's brilliant with it. And I think what we've done with the Blitzbox is we've made a way of playing sevens in like a South African Springbok kind of template, that we're hard on defense and then we still like lethal and structured in the way we attack. So I really enjoy that about our team, that out of all the teams out there, the South Africans just seem to love the defensive part especially more than the rest. And we're still abrasive and physical in that part of the game.
Awesome. Thanks, Jared. We have some listeners who want to come in. An old friend of the show, Caleb. You can start us off.
Thanks, Tala. Yeah, I think it's with regards to the Blitzbocker. I don't know if you have noticed how Neil Powell is heavily involved with the warm-up. And I've been fortunate enough to referee at some of the tournaments they've been involved in. He's actually in his boots during warm-up, and he's sometimes holding a tackle bag. And they've even at halftime, regardless whether they're losing or they're leading, they have a process, like you say, of you see them taking those deep breaths in, and then the players chat, and then he comes in with one or two technical input. But I just wanted to say, it's quite interesting how they always seem to find this talent that is like a replacement of whoever is missing. And you look at Selvin Davids, looks like he's a copy-paste Cecil Africa of sorts, you know. And the question I have is, haven't they always found a way to make sure that they always have key players injured? I don't know how they do that. And they still be able to have a well and able replacement. And my favorite player is Zane Davids. He looks like somebody who truly enjoys some good master course and malva pudding, but he's probably one of the toughest players on the field, you know. Doesn't look like a guy who should be playing sevens, but hey, looks have got nothing on him if he's playing like that. And I think it's brilliant how they managed to do that. But another question is with regards to succession planning, in with the academy coach coming in to take over. And I wonder who's going to take over from him to keep that conveyor belt of talent going on. And I think they need to be paid more to try and incentivize guys like Ruanel and Siabelo Sinatla to stay. In as much as they have Springbok dreamed, I think someone needs to sit them down and say, hey, maybe you're the Perry Baker of our lifetime. You're the Collins Injera. You're maybe the DJ Forbes, where you probably will never be able to play the All Blacks or Dan Norton, but you become a seventh legend. I think it's a conversation SA Rugby needs to have in relation with that. And I don't know if you guys watch them, but I've become a big fan of the Final Whistle with Swayster Brain, who's a regular with Nick Mallett yesterday, in terms of their take of what transpired over the weekend. I don't know if I missed that because I'm a bit late based on the time zone that I joined the podcast. In relation to the officiating that has been going on with a certain referee, I don't know if you guys are open to mention that, Marius van der Westhuizen, in terms of his approach to the game and how he hasn't been quite hitting the mark. And it seems like he seems to find a way to take the center stage in the match. And yeah, there was massive criticism about him from Skalkberger, as well as I think it was John Smith with the analysis on the SuperSport panel. So just, I don't know what's your take on that, but the Blitzbocker should go and long may it last. Thanks, Jens.
Thanks so much, Caleb. I think because we're going to talk about the URC games briefly just after this, so we can talk about the last few minutes of that Shark Stormers game, which were interesting to say the least. But yeah, I think Jared, you mentioned it, so I can go to Sean. Just with regards to that, like what Caleb said, it just seems like, yeah, Davis is almost like it's like he's the son of like Cecil Africa, who's the son of Jasper Cadill, is the son of Branko Dupria. Like there is that sort of like, I don't know where this factory is, but we just keep producing these playmakers for our Sevens team. And you know, you can see someone like Impey Fissa. He looks, he really reminds you of, you know, likes of his name escapes me now, but everyone seems to have, not that they're just picking people on just how they look and how they play, but there definitely is a plan as to, we want to do this and we want to play it this way, and especially trying to counteract sometimes the size that and the power advantage that, you know, the New Zealand or the Fiji teams would have, or even the USA teams.
Yeah, it's interesting. The factory is actually situated right next to the South African loose forward factory that we have somewhere in the country. That's where our Sevens Playmaker factory is, just in the shadow, you know, in the valley down by the side. But yeah, whatever they've got and how they've set it up in terms of their talent spotting and the work that is done, kind of off the ball by the management and coaching staff and sort of management team is incredible. And I agree when Caleb says we've got, like, we need to keep these guys in Sevens. I wish we could, man. I wish. And I honestly believe everyone wants to be a Springbok, and the guys will always push for that. But truth is, there's only a handful of guys that can do it. Warren Whiteley, Quagga, you know, like, then we can possibly, Ches and Colby, obviously. And there's a couple of other guys that possibly could be in the mix. But I think it's so important that we keep also, we need to get into the habit of having the Sevens conveyor belt transferring into our 15s. So if you take a look at the All Blacks and you have a look at how many of those All Blacks players played in Sevens, if you look at how many Super Rugby players played All Black Sevens, it's crazy. They look at it as a pathway, whereas we don't. So we need to look at a couple of things, like how can we do it? Because the truth is when a guy like Ruan Nel and Vanna Cook are playing in 15s, and the work and the aggression that they put in at ruck time on a counter ruck, the work they put in when they've got the ball is different to all of the 15 player backs. Very different. It's almost like some of the 15s backs are like, that's not my job to ruck, so I'm not going to, you know, I'll put in a half-ass effort. But they don't know the technical side. They don't know the aggression. It's weird. And the other thing is we need to make sure that our coaches in the 15s are able to best utilize those players. You know, I think like a guy like Sibela Sanatla, like that guy was going to smash all the records known to in this world and the next when it came to Sevens. I think he was going to do it. And he goes to a side like the Stormers, who historically haven't really made a hell of a lot of space for their wingers. Their wingers generally have to be big boys, and they are taking the ball through contact, through someone. They very seldom work space and then put him in a gap, and then he just hightails it to the corner, because that's essentially what he does and what he does exceptionally well. But he's got to fight through it, you know, he's got to fight through a couple of defenders and stuff like that. So I think that's where, you know, where we can get the best out of most of the guys. But yeah, flip, I'm loving what we're doing and how we're producing these players, and I don't know where they come from. But again, Caleb, you mentioned, like, we lose a top-class playmaker and all of a sudden this guy comes in and he settles in for a tournament and then absolutely starts cooking, and we don't miss the old guy, which is incredible. So I've spent quite a bit of time with the Sevens guys in Stellenbosch. I was doing a bit of work with the SA Under-20s and the Province Under-20s guys, and I spent some time and saw the Sevens. And they have an unbelievable group of people. And it must be, and it's so competitive. Like, there are guys there, it's exceptionally competitive. And everyone is pushing hard. And it's flipping great. And I'm loving it. And long may it continue. Yes.
Awesome. Let's go to someone's son. He also has a question or a comment.
I agree with a few of the points, especially about how creating 7s as a pipeline to 15s. I think there's a lot of guys we're going to lose in 15s because they're just not going to get the chance to showcase their full potential. And 7s offers the most amazing platform for them to just show up and show out, especially Chislin. Chislin came through 7s, ran it in the Curry Cup, and he's one of the best players in the world. When it comes to the Blitzbox, I have a few questions, especially about our dominance. We crushing it in the series, especially hopping through Malaga, going to Sevilla. The next series is in April, but our dominance doesn't translate in the big tournaments. Okay, not necessarily big tournaments, but those once-off tournaments, especially the World Cup and the Sevens World Cup and the Olympics. In the Olympics, I think we were playing for sixth place. We were knocked out by Argentina. So where do we lose it? Where do we lose our dominance? Because we've got our dominance in the 7 series, the HSBC 7s, but where do we lose it when going into tournaments like the Olympics? That's my only critique of the Blitzbox. I love their play, love their passion. Blitzbox are down 21-0 at halftime. You don't lose hope because you know they can come back. But where's that when it comes to your once-off tournaments, especially the Olympics? Because I was really optimistic about the Olympics and I was heavily disappointed. So I don't know if you guys can provide input and tell me where do they fall off?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I don't think many people know. It just seems like in once-off tournaments, it's sometimes a bit of sometimes just a brilliant performance from a Fiji or in this case Argentina in the Olympics. Sometimes we just fall off the boil. Sometimes we just don't time our form well. I think the last time we were this dominant, I think it was the 2009 season. We had a 7th World Cup at the end of it, and we inexplicably lost that World Cup as well. So it does seem like it's just, I don't know if we can classify it as a mental block like it is maybe for our cricket team. I don't think it's that serious, but it does seem to be just some series of misfortunate events when we get to the ones World Tournament. So hopefully in September in Cape Town, let's boss can put that all right. Jared Shaw, do you guys have anything to add about that?
No, Tala, I think you sort of covered it as well. It's just, if I can put it this way, they always say the bounce of the ball in rugby looking for either side, and with how much space there is on a sevens pitch, it's pretty much in the same vicinity as with the 15s. So, in the 15s, one ball bounces the wrong way, and you can maybe make it up, but in sevens, that one ball bouncing the wrong way, just you back and you down by 17 or 14 points, and it's, you don't have much time to catch up on it. So I think that's sort of how I feel about it, and I think it'll take one tournament to break that duck, and then we'll sort of dominate in those dominate to a degree in the rest of the competitions after that one, and hopefully that one is here in South Africa.
Perfect, and yeah, we will hopefully try to get into prime form by September. Thank you so much for that question. I think let's move on to sort of the final, just round up with URC. I think, yeah, as Caleb mentioned earlier, I think there was a very controversial ending to the game. And yeah, I don't think it's necessary for us to sort of dissect it in detail, but it does, I think there are some interesting sort of trends that we've seen from the past few weeks with the URC teams. It doesn't seem like, number one, none of the four teams want to actually dominate and take the conference forward, which will hurt us, I think, in the end for, like, you know, in terms of getting teams into the knockouts for the URC, it doesn't look good. Our chances don't look good for us having two teams in the quarterfinals. It looks like probably only the conference winner will get through. And then number two, it just seems like you can only expect 50 minutes of good rugby from the Sharks, Stormers, Bulls, and the Lions right now. Anything more is just too much for them. But let's focus on just the ending of the bizarre ending of the Sharks and the Stormers game. Jared, sorry to put you on this spot, but what the hell happened?
Yeah, I think you started off well by saying that we only get 50 minutes of good rugby out of one of the teams on their day kind of thing. And I think while I was watching the game, I sort of got lazy at the end of the that I took a, was busy having a couple of tweets or having a beer, and I thought the Sharks were cruising home. And I think that's exactly how the Sharks felt. And yeah, I think there were some dodgy calls. I think that Fassin, right at the end, knew what he was doing, and he knew that he was compromised, and he just threw his arm out. I don't think the penalty trial was the wrong decision, but I think there was some terrible decisions in the build-up to that. But yeah, when you have your fly half missing shots at goal early on in the game where you are dominant and you can start building a hefty tally, it does come back to bite you later on in the game. I really did enjoy Butcher Chamberlain's drop goal, and I'm a massive fan of that. I think I said it earlier in the week or the week before that we should normalize drop goal attempts from goal line dropouts, and he seems to be the leader in doing that. But he wants to knock over the nice 40-meter drop goals. He needs to kick over his shots from the tee as well. So I think there's a bit of issues there with the Sharks. I think the Stormers really did show up in the pack. I think Brock Harris was a game-changing substitution for them. Ox had his way with... I think it's Sazi, the Stormers tight end. Yeah, and it's how great is it to see Warwick Lyons playing the way he is? He produced, I said it on the weekend, he produced a Springbok level performance. And if Jacques must be watching this and thinking, okay, great, now I'm starting to get some awesome opportunities at fullback. I've got the likes of Fassi, Kalant, or Cooking. I've got the veteran in Billy LaRue still playing the way he does. And you still got someone like Francois Steyn to fall back on as well.
Yeah, it's also very nice of the Stormers to start with Kalant on the bench just to give other teams a chance. I don't know if it's just they want to get the sportsmanship award for the ERC, but it's really sweet of them to give them a head start. Let's bring in Caleb. And then we can start wrapping up.
Yeah, I think with regards to the URC, the comment you made there in terms of we only get 50 minutes of rugby from any of the four teams, I think that's because with the exception of the Sharks to some extent, but I see everybody trying to do the Springbok Jacques Ninaba Rassie Erasmus template of let's dominate up front, and the Lions, they're 20 points, three down, they get a penalty, and they go for poles. Like, I think there's a lack of bravery there. There's a lack of backing yourself up to say we need to score twice to be within this match. Like, I don't know, kick it to the corner, at least try the mall to try and get some 7 points, because you're not going to dominate a Leinster up front. You're not going to dominate, like, we want to keep the scoreboard ticking. No, it's not a World Cup final where the box do a middle field mall to try and gain 3 points to try and create some breathing space. I think we need some teams to become a little bit more brave, like you say, with the Stormers. Put Warwick Gallant in early. Be brave about it. Have a whole backline of fly halves and fullbacks and Damien Willemse and Manny Lebok. Get them cooking. I don't think there's massive defensive frailties with them. You still have Rowan Nell somewhere in the middle there to make those defensive decisions. And yeah, I think it's worrying when teams start to play test match rugby in competitions like the URC as well as the Curry Cup. And I think that's a problem, because you can only play that type of rugby if you're a Springbok that can bring Archie Snyman, Luteaga from the bench, where you've started with Eben Etzelbeth and somebody else, you know, and Franco Mostert. You won't be able to play that game to 80 minutes with the type of depth that these teams have, with the exception of the Bulls. So I think that's the problem. But just to track back a little bit, are the Blitzbok at the island of the Sevens circuit? or maybe the Proteas of rugby? So a question that needs to be answered. But yeah, I think we need to get our teams playing a little bit more brave rugby. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be very. I think it's an interesting point. I don't know if that is the solution, but it's definitely there. You can see why we struggled overseas, and I think there is a clear. We're just not putting a game together or a good game together in all aspects. You know, I think that another big factor is that the only team with a solid fly half right now that's playing well is the Bulls with Morning Spain. The other fly halves, you know, for different reasons, all young and inexperienced, and they're all just, you know, not quite hitting the mark each every minute. Like, for example, Fred Zeilinger last week, his first half was absolutely amazing. In the second half, he was absolutely trash. I have no idea, I think, what happened to him. It's, yeah, so there's a bit of brilliance and then a bit of just, you know, like, rubbish mixed in between that.
Yeah, just a quick one, Tala. With regards to the Warwick Gallant thing, imagine being Billy LaRue. We've all been in high school, and we've all wanted, you know what I'm talking about, as boys. We're all boys on the podcast. And then, you know, somebody who's way cooler than you gets what you thought you wanted. I think that's what's happening to Vili, where you've run your course, where what made you cool anymore is not cool anymore because there are other people doing it better. And it must be terrible for him playing in Japan, because he'll always be cooking, because he's not going to face tough opposition as he would like, where guys like Dwayne Vermeulen at 35, whatever, are still doing it at top flight rugby. Let's face it, Japan is probably like it's a nice rest for guys like Peter Steph Tutoi, who probably have emptied the tank in the last 3 years. But I think Umvili might just, we love him for what he does at the back there with the young Mapimpi in terms of test caps and the young Chesley and Spoo and Kosi. But I think his time is slowly done, and he can see it happening. He can see your end coming, and you can do nothing about it.
I think we'll see. One thing I know about Vili LaRue, he never seems to go away as people want. He always seems to come back with just enough brilliance to keep it there. But I think we will end it there. Thank you so much, ladies and gents, for joining us today. Thank you so much for contributions from, you know, the floor. Thank you so much, like, for example, Caleb, and, for coming in and interacting with us. Yeah, we are looking to, we're just finalizing channel, and we're looking to sort of set up a few things around the Six Nations and Super Rugby Pacific as well. So just look out for our website, look out for our tweets, just to see what is going on. And yeah, we will see you on the Rugby streets during the week. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, guys. Thanks, gents.
Bye, everyone. Thank you all again for listening. Have a good week.